know, a lot of times when we think of innovation, we think of new gadgets and all sorts of new toys and technologies. I actually think of it in a different way, which is, can we break out of the assumptions and the rigid ways in which we've gone about trying to work in communities, which, as you and Evan know, have too often produced a kind of toxic public discourse, have created mistrust and division in our communities, and can, at least the public innovators we work with, can we focus more on what people's aspirations are in our community, developing strategies that literally fit the local context of a community, and to innovate in ways that we're actually developing the capacity and strengths of a community as we're doing our work, which means building new networks for learning and innovation, building leaders who want to lead in different ways, building organizations that are fighting for the common good, not just their own agenda. And when we find people are willing to do these things, they can produce results that actually move communities forward.
So tell us a little bit about, you've set this goal, I think you made an announcement about a bit over a week ago, about setting this target to train, a core of 5,000 new public innovators by 2016. You just sort of outline what that objective is.
Well, our objective is, as you said, we've made two bold goals public. One is, as you said, we want to train up 5,000 new public innovators across the country, and we want to grow what we call our public innovator core, which are people who may not be trained in our approach, but who are using it in their community and want to support this kind of work. We want to grow that public innovator core to 100,000 Americans. And the reason why is this. You know, we know that the Institute on its own is not going to move the country forward. But we believe if we can get 5,000 new public innovators trained, we can help create a different path for the country by demonstrating four things. One, creating more proof points where people are innovating and creating change in their communities on everything from public schools to reducing crime to making sure that kids can read by the third grade. Second, we want to demonstrate with these 5,000 public innovators that we can actually change the way we work in communities, which is what I hear Americans saying they want more than anything else. Third, we want to develop an army of storytellers who can actually tell stories about how we're doing things differently and can sort of create a new can-do narrative that we don't need to resign ourselves to the way things are going now. And fourth, we want to make sure that every person who wants to act in their community on a different path can, for instance, go to our website or other people's websites and get the kinds of tools and resources they need to take action in their own lives and in their own neighborhoods.
We're talking to Rich Harwood from the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. And, Rich, so many of the broad goals that you outline are goals that a lot of people would share or support. And then the question becomes, I think when you read through some of the literature that you guys have, I think one of the stumbling blocks is it's hard to fully understand or envision what a public innovator looks like. Can you give me an example? Give me a specific example of somebody who has innovated effectively through your program, helped bring about a change in a specific community.
Sure. We're working in Battle Creek, Michigan right now on a host of issues. The number of innovators we're working with there are people who are working as part of the local United Way, people who are working in their community foundation, who have come together and decided that they need to figure out how kids are going to move through the transition from middle school to high school. And what they've done is they've pulled together the local Chamber of Commerce, the local community college, the local United Way, and other groups to rally around kids and to create new programs and efforts that will support kids moving through that. Now, you might say, well, those are all people who are part of an organization, right, leaders of a local United Way. One of the main movers in Battle Creek that we've been working with is a woman named Talia Chapman. I met her a number of years ago. She was a real estate broker. And as she went through our work and learned how to become a public innovator, she said, you know, we need to pull together people in Battle Creek to have a different kind of conversation about where we want this community to go to and how we're going to get there. And she just started, Evan, by pulling small groups of people together and then leaders of different organizations. Remember, this is just, she was a real estate broker. She had never done this kind of work before. And now she heads up an organization, which is one of the main groups in Battle Creek that's rallying around this middle school transition. So what we find in communities is it could be someone who's head of a major organization, a university president, and it can be someone in a local neighborhood or a local church who has no official title, but who wants to bring people together to improve their community.
And most of the time, when you look at especially public school districts and especially urban school districts or districts that have challenging either economics, challenging home life situations for some of the kids, you talk about building better public schools and more kids reading. Most of the time, I assume, there is an openness to working with new ideas or people who haven't been involved before. But you do need to secure the thumbs up from a school district
that's
to try
right.
new things, et cetera. And I imagine that's an important barrier to cross.
It's an incredibly important barrier. And in fact, in Battle Creek, this is one of the challenges right now. I mean, we've done lots of work across the country in communities and reconnecting communities and schools. And as you're suggesting, you know, not in all communities, but in enough communities, one of the great resistors to change are the people in school districts. Right, principals, superintendents of schools, boards of education in Mobile, Alabama, where we've done this work, groups of people got together to start to try to change education in that community. It took 15 years before they could change out the school board, change out the school superintendent, and ultimately start to develop better policies around the distribution of teachers around urban, suburban, and rural schools. In making sure that there were adequate books across those different areas, in making sure that there was adequate transportation across those areas. And what it really required was the community coming together, expressing their views. But as you're suggesting, it was a long fight and a long battle before change actually emerged.
Is that I just wanted to ask about this issue of inclusion and equity in processes of innovation, because I think, you know, in our reporting project, we do a lot about innovation and economic change and changes in communities. But I detect that often there are people who are left behind in processes of innovation and change. So is that a challenge as well in your mind, the idea of just being able to make sure that innovation is inclusive and equitable, you know, as it is inevitable?
Yeah, you know, there are two different pieces to this. One is, and our work addresses this squarely, which is, you know, to whom are we listening in a community when we're talking about, for instance, you're talking later in the program about how communities make transitions or transformations. And one of the key issues in communities innovating and thinking about their future is who's really at the table? And so often what we do is we think if we just have the right leaders at the table, we've done our job, or if we just have token representation of different groups, we've done our job. And here's the test that we give to innovators in communities when they're trying to create transformation. Can you stand up? If I got 200 or 300 people from across a community like Rochester in an auditorium, and I asked you to go to the middle of that room and stand up on a table and look into the eyes of the people in that room, could you reflect their shared aspirations for their community? Could you reflect the kinds of challenges that people are wrestling with when they live their lives daily? Could you do it in a way in which people would recognize themselves and it wouldn't sound like just a think tank report from the Brookings Institution or from some university? And the reason why this is so important is because in order for us to transform communities and to innovate in them, we've got to reflect people's aspirations and their concerns moving forward, because otherwise we don't really have the kind of legitimacy and credibility that's required to create public will to move forward.
Do people just say, oh, you know, we're actually doing all this stuff, you know, we're, you know, yeah, what do you bring to the table? You know, you want to come in here and run your fancy workshops or whatever, and, you know, we're already talking to everyone, and, you know, I do political, you know, town hall meetings and listen to the community. So what's different about the kind of approach that you might take?
Yeah, well, on this one piece of innovation, which is to make sure we have deep knowledge of the community, some people are doing a really good job, and we applaud them and cheer them and hold them up as examples. But more times than not, what we find is we focus first and foremost in communities on getting people to talk about the problems we face. And when we do that, inevitably we end up in heated arguments about who's to blame and why these things came about and pointing fingers at one another and casting aspersions, and so we're not able to move forward. We're right back in gridlock. Or we spend a lot of time on visioning exercises which get people to blue sky but have very little relationship to the reality. And so what we say to folks is, you step in trying to move a community forward is to focus on shared aspirations and the challenges in reaching those. But that's just, you know, that's just the first step. There are a number of other things that, that need to take place in order to move forward.
We're talking to Rich Harwood, who is the founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. They would like to attract 5,000 new public innovators. We're talking about what that means, and we're also talking about some of the specific cases. Now, you mentioned Battle Creek, Michigan, and that was a case that most Americans have not heard about. Here's a case where many Americans have heard about but might not have known your involvement, and that's Sandy Hook Elementary. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, December 2012, Adam Lanza, a gunman, walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School and massacred 20 first graders and shot six adults, shot dead six adults. And a number of weeks after that occurred, I got a call from the mayor of Newtown, Connecticut, asking me if I would be willing to design and lead a process by which the community could decide what to do with the Sandy Hook Elementary School. But, you know, what I came and I accepted the assignment, but what I came to know pretty quickly was this really wasn't a decision about a school building. It was really fundamentally a decision about could a community that had gone through trauma and despair, could it really pivot to a sense of healing and hope? And that's what I was asked to do and help lead a task force of 28 elected officials to move through.
When you say what to do with the school, you mean what to do with the physical building.
Yeah, you know, after the massacre occurred, they, you know, as you can imagine, it was a crime scene, so they had to shut it down. The kids from Sandy Hook Elementary School started to attend school in a building that had been empty, that an adjacent school district opened up for them and actually put Sandy Hook Elementary School's name on the front of the building. And, you know, then the task for the community, one of the first public decisions Newtown had to make after the massacre was, do we go back into the building? Do we renovate it? Do we tear it down and build anew? Or do we go to an entirely new site and start again? And so over a couple of few month process, we examined those options. And as I said, you can imagine, you know, on the one hand, this is sort of like, what do you do with a building? But really, this was about how does a community work through this kind of trauma and literally decide whether or not they even are ready to think about how to move ahead.
Rich, when the Harwood Institute is working on a specific project, whether it's really anywhere in the country, it doesn't matter where it is, but certain projects are going to be a little bit more, I don't want to say political, but sensitive and difficult than others. And I imagine Sandy Hook was toward the top of the list of community sensitivity. Everyone's going to have an opinion on what should happen. Give me a sense for an approach to public innovation that says, we understand you will not always please everybody, but we've got to reach an outcome that is for the best for the community. And sometimes that's not always so easy and obvious.
It's not so easy and obvious. And I think what becomes like in Sandy Hook, what was important was setting up a process that was seen as being methodical, you know, that had a series of steps that people could see, that was transparent, that there would be no surprises for people. And then third, that there was, you know, one of the things I said coming in was we've got to make sure there's room for conversation here. And as you can imagine, in a place like Sandy Hook, there were a lot of different opinions. I mean, there was a segment of the community didn't even believe we should be talking about this yet. And then there were divisions between and among groups about how to move this forward. And in fact, on the night that we declared we were going to make a decision that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times wrote articles about, 20 to 30 teachers released a letter that day that said they would never go back to that site, whether it's a renovation or a rebuild, and declared that they wouldn't teach there again. And so we had to deal with all those issues. And I think what becomes important in these things is that people have faith in the process, that there's enough transparency in it, that different points of view in this case were literally aired out in public over time. And that when people were reaching a decision, in this case the 28 elected officials, that people perceived and believed that they had weighed different points of view. And you know what happened at the end of this was a community where we thought there might be a split decision or even a decision where it was two-thirds, one-third, it was a unanimous decision at the end. And people by and large in the community accepted it, and even those who didn't agree with it said at least it was a fair process.
How important are those, I guess, those tangible to put deadlines in there, Rich? Because it seems to me communities tend to show enormous capacity for having these complex conversations at times of crisis. But often, you know, consultation and so on can be seen to be sort of an entropic process that really doesn't deliver anything. So is it really important to say we are going to have an outcome of this no matter what?
In Sandy Hook, it was. You know, in other communities like where we're working in Flint, Michigan, or Youngstown, Ohio, or Spokane, Washington, where we're now doing a lot of work with folks, you know, it's a very different process there. And I think this may have more relevance to your subsequent segments. There, the question is, how does a community innovate and create a different trajectory for itself, right? So how does it begin to, like in a place like Youngstown, where they lost all their steel mills, where people didn't trust local leaders, where there weren't organizations that people trusted, where the mob, was widely recognized as running many things for many years. How is it that you move out of being stuck as a community and start to innovate to move forward? And there, it's a very different process. What we find is what becomes really important is how do you create pockets of change that people can start to see where innovative things are taking place? How can you build leaders and organizations who can spread those pockets and start to connect them over time? And how can a community like Rochester, for instance, or Youngstown, how does it begin to develop a new can-do narrative about itself that's rooted in something real and not just simply public relations? And there, deadlines play much less of a role. What matters more is, can people start to see pockets of progress? Can we name them? Can we hold them up? Do they give us a sense of confidence that we're able to move forward as a community? That is more of a longer-term process that needs to take place.
And that is going to be an ideal segue toward our later segments today on this program, Rich, because we're going to be talking about legacy cities, American cities that have struggled with the loss of large manufacturers, et cetera.
Right.
It's certainly true here with sort of the big three and the change in the face of the local employment economy. But when you talk about going into places like Youngstown, it could easily be Rochester. And there are community debates about what should replace certain industries, how that should happen. Should the government have a hand in rebuilding certain structures? Should the government have a hand in certain hiring? And so often that veers into politics. And your organization is listed as nonpartisan. You talk about going into places like Newtown where there's such a sensitive debate, and you find a way to end up with a solution that at least everyone feels like it's a fair process, even if I don't agree with it.
Right.
That's supposed to be the definition of politics in general in this country, and yet so often the losers in politics feel like they were somehow wronged. So I feel like what you and your organization does seems to find a way to transcend what is supposed to be the way politics works in this country.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and this goes back to some of your earlier questions, and these might be better answers in a way. You know, in terms of innovating in a community like Rochester or Youngstown or Flint or Newark or Detroit or Las Vegas, where we've done work, you know, we can spend all our time in the early stages of a community trying to get on a new path, trying to come up with comprehensive master plans for the community. And what I've found is that stifles innovation a lot of times, because what it does is it tries to coordinate all our activities and get everyone aligned in a certain kind of way, get everyone moving in the same direction. And in fact, one of the things that we need early on when communities are trying to create a new path is we need to innovate. We need to try different kinds of things. We need to see what works and what doesn't work. We've got to be willing to fail and learn from our failures. That's what's happening in Detroit right now. The kinds of things that are bubbling up in Detroit, whether it's the new watch company, Spinola, or Quicken Books, or the kinds of small startups that are happening, or the civic activities where people are deciding that the city can't take care of parks, so people are banding together to take care of parks. All of these things no one could have predicted by doing a research study. They sprung up over time, and they're telling Detroit, they're sending signals about, well, what might work here? What are people willing to do? How do we bring people together in a different kind of way? And all of those things that I'm mentioning are beneath politics, in a sense. We've got to take politics out of it and focus on how do we innovate, bring people together, get things moving, get the juices flowing, so that that we can learn what the right path is.
And before we let Rich go, I know we want to make sure people are reminded the reason Matthew Leonard booked him to come on the show is this push for public innovators, right, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely, and kind of accessibility to innovation. Just one quick question to wrap up. Rich, thanks for your time today. Just in terms of your own funding, what are your main funding sources? Where do you get your money for your operations from?
So we get funding from national foundations like the Kellogg Foundation. We get funding from some of our partners like United Way Worldwide, and then we get funding from a third source, which is people going to our public innovators training, what we call public innovator labs.
So that's the kind of the coalface, the sort of retail end of what you
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
Okay. And people can go to the HarwoodInstitute.org for more information. And these public innovation labs, which we'd like to talk about more in, you know, in more detail, I suspect, going forward, but they're kind of national events. They're events that...
interesting. I was just in New Orleans this week, and they want to bring... So a lot of times we bring labs to a local community, like in Battle Creek or Youngstown, where we can actually build a critical mass of public innovators in a community and bring together the organizations who want to do business differently, and that helps to begin the process of shifting the civic culture in the community so work can get done in a different way.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, Rich Harwood from the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. Thanks for the time on this Innovation Friday, Rich.
Good to be with you. Thanks.